We are the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short.
Hello, welcome to the Papers podcast series for the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. I'm Umar Taseeb, a professor at the University of York. In this series, we speak to authors of papers published in one of ACAM's three journals. These are the Journal of Child Psychology and Psychiatry, commonly known as JCPP, the Child and Adolescent Mental Health, known as CAM, and JCPP Advances. Today, I'm talking to Dr. Kenny Chu, clinical lecturer and research tutor at the University of East Anglia. Kenny is the lead author of a paper entitled Social Anxiety Symptoms and Their Relationship with Suicidal Ideation and Depressive Symptoms in Adolescents, a Prospective Study in JCPP Advances. This paper will be the focus of today's podcast. If you're a fan of our Papers podcast series, please subscribe on your preferred streaming platform. Let us know how we did with a rating or review, and do share with your friends and colleagues. Kenny, thank you so much for joining us. Can you start by just giving us a quick introduction about who you are and what you do?
Sure. My name is Dr. Ken Chu, and I'm a clinical psychologist, and I currently work as a clinical lecturer and a research tutor at the Declan Psy program based at the University of East Anglia. And I enjoy conducting research to advance our knowledge of improving mental health of children and adolescents. And over the years, I've developed specific focus on understanding social anxiety in adolescents and developing effective treatments for them.
Thank you. And let's turn to the paper. Can you give us a brief overview of your paper?
Certainly. This paper represents a collaboration with Dr. Eleanor Lee, social anxiety expert based at the Oxford University, and Professor Agarius Tringaris, an expert in the area of depression, who's currently based at UCL. Among the three of us, we began to develop an interest in understanding more about the adverse effects of social anxiety on young people. So in our previous research, we've looked into quite a couple range of outcomes, including academic functioning, social functioning, concentration in class. And this time, we'd like to understand a bit more about the relationship between social anxiety symptoms and suicidal ideation, as well as other depressive symptoms in adolescents. And as we know that depression is a condition that composes of multiple features with low mood, lack of interest, and for some, that might involve suicidal ideation. In this project, we try to look into the relationship by adopting a more dimensional approach, by breaking them a bit down, and to look at the differential relationship with social anxiety. So in this project, we use data from a large community sample with the data collected from the Neuroscience and Psychiatry Network to investigate whether social anxiety measured at the start was associated with later suicidal thoughts and other depressive symptoms 2 years later, and whether these relationships were mediated by depressive symptoms at 1 year.
Excellent, thank you. And you've touched a bit upon the next question I was going to ask you, but do you just want to expand on the methodology? So your secondary analysis of existing data. Do you want to tell us a bit more about the data set?
Regarding the methodology used in the study, we used our secondary data analysis of data collected from the Neuroscience and Psychiatry Network, also known as NSPN. So in this NSPN initiative, researchers collected lots of data from young people aged 14 to 24 from different parts of the UK, and they followed them over 2 years. And they've collected quite a lot of different data, including their experience of internalizing symptoms, as well as externalizing behaviors, as well as brain imaging data. So in the study we published, we used some of the questionnaires that tap into social anxiety, depression, and suicidal ideation. And more importantly, there are also follow-up studies looking into cognitive functioning and some neuroscience research. So it's a really rich, massive, well-thought-after data set.
Did you access the data remotely, or were you working in Cambridge? How did this come about?
When I first started off the role as a research tutor in the program, I start thinking about research projects that are available to trainees. one of my amazing colleagues, Professor Richard Meiser-Sutton, who came across this data set and put me in touch with the group there. So for discussion with the group, I was really fortunate to get access to the data set to start answering some questions using this amazing resources.
Oh, excellent. Well, I'm not sure if I mentioned, but I worked on the NSBN project. So I was there as a postdoc in like 2012, 2014, that during that period. I led on the data collection for this as a weird coincidence. So I recruited the schools, colleges, universities, and like it was really a really fun time. Yeah. I got to drive around lots of Cambridge, and then like we'd get like bags full of like questionnaires coming in through the post. And then so it's really nice that people are using the data.
I'm so glad to be talking to you today, Uma, because I feel very blessed to have access to such amazing resources and through that to be able to do something meaningful. You also remind me of in maybe 5 to 10 years ago, it's not too long ago, it's actually pre-pandemic, that even in my doctoral clinical psychology training, I was printing out 600 questionnaires using a suitcase, going to schools to get data, and going back to in front of the computer and type that in. But things have changed drastically.
And you describe in your paper that you had measures of anxiety, depressive symptoms, and suicide ideation. Can you tell us a bit more about those measures, assuming the questionnaire-based measures?
Indeed, they are questionnaires measures. It was an interesting process to figure out to what extent we could use an existing data set like this to answer a question that might not be quite immediately obvious. Because, for example, we were able to identify a proxy measure of social anxiety from the revised Children's Anxiety Impressions Scale. And we were able to, not only looking into depressive symptoms captured by the mood and feelings questionnaire, we also found that in the same questionnaire, there are actually items tapping into suicidal ideation. And there's research suggesting that these items can form a subscale that has some good enough psychometric properties as a standalone measurement. And that's how we start becoming excited about the possibility of, actually asking questions that have never been thought about.
Thank you. And so my understanding of it is that you have a time point zero, which is the baseline assessment, and the young people did a series of questionnaires, and then you have a follow-up a year later, and then a follow-up a further year later. And as with all longitudinal studies, you had sample attrition. So you had people who took part at the first time point who didn't take part at the second or third time point, and those kinds of issues around missing data. How did you deal with that missing data?
Thanks for this question. Yes, in longitudinal cohort studies like this, missing data is very common, and due to various reasons, it could be because of people deciding not to take part, or there could be logistical reason why sometimes data cannot be collected. And I've experience of conducting this sort of longitudinal cohort research. And from there, I learned that in order to conduct analysis to find findings that are valid and reliable, we need to figure out solutions, such as looking into the pattern of missing data to see how were they missed, were there a pattern in it? And based on that observation and also consideration of the reason for why data are missing, I've learned that it's been possible to apply methodologies such as multiple data imputation to try to account for those missing data and improve statistical power to test our hypothesis. And while imputation is not perfect when there is a high percentage of missing data, from experience I've learned that it's good practice to look at both complete data analysis as well as data analysis using some form of data imputation methods to see if we arrive at a similar conclusion.
Yeah, and I think that's important. And did you test both with and without imputed data? And did you arrive at a similar conclusion?
Yes, I did look into using two analytic approaches, and the results are largely consistent. And that's also not surprising, given this is such a big data set and the data collection qualities, in my opinion, is great. Again, if they're pointing drastically different conclusion, then there obviously there will be more challenges of how to interpret the discrepancy.
And One of the things that I really liked about this paper was that you pre-registered your analysis. So, and that's particularly interesting because it's secondary analysis of existing data. So when we access those data sets, I think there's a risk that people might end up on a fishing expedition where you have lots of data and then you're trying to find patterns and effects. And the more you look, the more you're likely to find. So the fact that you pre-registered this data analysis is fantastic. Can you talk us through your experience of pre-registering this analysis?
Yes, pre-registering the analysis on the Open Science Framework was a new experience to me. And by working with Eleanor and Agarius, both of whom are experts in the field and have lots of experience, I've learned about the importance of developing our hypothesis and analytic plan in advance. And to tolerate the temptation to conduct exploratory analysis. And the experience to me, it was initially challenging because I wasn't involved in collecting the data and I have no idea why data were missed. I do not know why certain questionnaires were used and how validated they are. So there are lots of background work needed that needs to be done through literature search to be sure that this is a viable direction. So I would describe this as short-term pain period. But as soon as we publish the plan and start running analysis, I did have a very different and more positive experience down the line because I know exactly what we were looking for. And there were no excuse for me to branch out to explore other alternatives so I can keep focused and be faithful to what I've planned to do. Overall, I would definitely recommend doing pre-registration for secondary data analysis. And in fact, this has become a culture in the UEA ClinSci ID program that, for example, all of the trainees I supervise who are working on using similar approach, all of them pre-register their proposal before actually looking into data.
As you say, it's a fantastic way forward because a lot of the thinking around what the analysis will look like, what the models that you will fit will be, and which variables you want to use, you do that up front. So then when you actually have the data in front of you and going to do the analysis, you've done a lot of the hard work already. And then it's just the technical aspects of doing the analysis. So yeah, I think it's a fantastic way forward. And I'm so glad you did it for this paper.
Yeah, thank you.
Just to move on to the analytic models themselves. So I can see that you did regression models and mediation models, and those were fantastic. And we'll talk about what you found in a few moments' time. But I did wonder when I was reading this that the data set, because there's three time points, and given your research questions, I did wonder whether it would lend itself to a random intercept cross like panel model, where you can look at the within and between person variation over time. Is that something you considered?
I did consider this way of analyzing the data, and particularly because it could account for distinguish between within person and between person effects. However, admittedly, this is not something I thought of when I pre-registered a study, and it was something that came up after I submitted the manuscript that I become more apply more critical appraisal to understand to what extent I need to look into these more complex way of analyzing data. So we did, within the research group, we did have discussion on, do we need to make a drastic change on our pre-registration to use the different analytic methods? But since the paper has been submitted and has been reviewed once, and it wasn't our initial intention, we didn't report that finding, but I do acknowledge that it would be helpful and perhaps more rigorous to conduct an analysis of such.
I suppose not even more rigorous. And then also I think that it's just a different way of doing it. And I think that it's important to point out that the random intercept cross like panel model isn't the answer to all of the problems. And, you know, there are a number of assumptions that have to be met, as you know. And so I suppose like it's just a different way of doing it. Let's talk about your findings. So we've gone through some of the rationale and then we've talked about the cohort itself and the analysis methods. What did you find and what findings would you particularly like to highlight?
Our key findings are that the young people's self-reported baseline social anxiety symptoms were associated with their self-reported suicidal ideation and other depressive symptoms measured 2 years later, even after we control for baseline level of the predicted outcomes. So that's one of the findings. And in addition, when we conduct mediation analysis, we notice that there's evidence suggesting that the relationship between these variables were partially explained or mediated by depressive symptoms at 1 year. And there are many ways to interpret the data because they are correlational data and observational data. I will be cautious of not making a bold causal inference here, but one interpretation could be that maybe this is showing that social anxiety could play a role in the maintenance of suicidal ideation, as well as the persistence of depressive symptoms. And I think that it would be fair to at least state that as a possible explanation, given that there will be ethical challenges of using other ways, such as experimental study, to see if social anxiety indeed cause depression or suicidal ideation. So that would be the key findings we reported in the paper. Yeah.
And what might the implications of those findings for clinicians, for example, or other researchers?
One major implication is that it would be helpful to consider that for young people who experience an elevated level of social anxiety in a community, not even a clinical population, the fact of this high level social anxiety could be a sign of a risk factor for them experiencing later suicidal thoughts and other depressive symptoms. So that might point to the importance of providing assessment that could accurately, sensitively look into all these aspects and highlight the importance of supporting young people to overcome their social anxiety if they feel distressed by it. And building on this research, maybe the results also suggest that there might be a need to further understand the mechanism linking social anxiety to suicidal ideation, particularly because there are many theories around why people develop suicidal thoughts or commit to report suicidal behaviors. One aspect is about the interpersonal aspects, that people might be more vulnerable to experience these thoughts when they experience negative social experience and feel defeated by that. And this is something quite special about and quite specific to social anxiety in adolescent periods. So there might be something more to look into to understand the underlying mechanism of it. And when I say mechanism, that could be the social anxious thoughts and the suicidal thoughts. Maybe there are also other beliefs or imageries or other cognitive processes in play.
Thank you. And I suppose you've already touched on this, so we'll just expand on that. So where next? Are you planning any follow-up research, or is there anything else in the pipeline that you'd like to share with us?
We do have a discussion on follow-up research ideas, and especially we seem to have received quite overwhelming interest from different researchers about this project, particularly in relation to the link between social anxiety and suicidal ideation. And of course, because as we do experience a replication crisis, so it's always advisable to replicate the study using more comprehensive multi-item measures of social anxiety and suicidal ideation, maybe more than through self-report, but using other reports. So to build up the evidence that this is indeed something that can be replicated, because there are not many studies that look into this relationship. And in addition, perhaps there's value to investigate other outcomes, such as suicidal behaviors or attempts, or non-suicidal self-injuries. So there are lots of thoughts and behaviors or other processes that might be in play when a person feels so vulnerable to a point that they become distressed with these thoughts, and it is worth understanding more.
And I think one of the things that I think I might suggest is that I'm quite sure ALSPARC, the Avon Longitudinal Study of Parents and Children, has like interview data on like mental health. So they might have stuff on social anxiety and then subsequent suicide ideation. So I mean, I suppose it's a different informant than self-report. But anyway, that might be useful to look at if that's something you're interested in.
I've looked into it, and I think so. And it's certainly that's a go-to place to get the UK data.
One step ahead.
I'm glad you mentioned the same. It's actually quite feasible nowadays because of these data available. And that means that that challenges us as researcher to develop different skills, such as being aware of where what kind of data we're looking into, what are the analytical skills in our toolbox we could use, and when we combine them together, are we going to get an answer that has very good brain potential impact? Another place could be looking outside UK, but there might be other big data sets such as the ABCD data that might also provide some other insights. And in addition, we might be good to look into other data sets that collect from a more specific cohort, such as people with neurodiversity, to see if we observe similar association or are they actually stronger than in the community population. So there are plenty of opportunities out there, and which really is really exciting time that we could now be able to do this without dragging our suitcase and collecting data. We're building on the giant's shoulder and working together as a scientific community.
And finally, what's your take-home message for our listeners?
The first take-home message is that there's always something more to learn about mental distress and the relationship. And in this project, even just by looking into the relationship between different forms of mental health symptoms, and are producing quite valuable insights. So that's something potentially we could look into further. And the second take-home message, which is more generic, is that it is completely feasible to conduct studies like this nowadays. And everybody could do that as long as we know where to look for data. We've done a literature review carefully online with the blessing of the data holders. It's so feasible nowadays to discover a new insight. And I do really encourage everyone to do that more.
Thank you ever so much. For more details on the paper and Dr. Kenny Chu, please visit the ACAM website, that's www.acam.org, and Twitter at ACAM. ACAM is spelled A-C-A-M-H. And don't forget, follow us on your preferred streaming platform. Let us know if you enjoy the podcast with a rating or review, and do share with your friends and colleagues.